Welcome to Westmoreland Community Connections on WHJB. I'm your host, Jennifer Mealy. I always get really excited because about once a year I'm able to track down the famous artistic director for the Westmoreland Symphony Orchestra, and that is Daniel Meyer. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jennifer. Thank you.
You are a busy guy. You are everywhere all the time. Why don't you tell people at home a little bit about all of your different roles in all of the symphonies throughout, I think, Pennsylvania and beyond the region, really.
Sure. I mean, it's not without precedent. I mean, I have a number of colleagues who are also holding down multiple positions, but mine are largely centered in this region, as you said. I'm music director of the Westmoreland Symphony, of course, which involves at least four main stage classical concerts a year, plus a full run of the Nutcracker Ballet, and then some wonderful youth concerts and some summer concerts. And now we're starting to add some more pops concerts as well. So that's one aspect of what I do. Of course, I'm also music director of the Erie Philharmonic in Erie, Pennsylvania. And that's 10 main stage concerts a year at the historic Warner Theater, which is another movie palace, beautifully restored movie palace. I'm also artistic director of the Blue Water Chamber Orchestra, which is a really fine group of musicians in Cleveland, Ohio. And they perform at least four main stage concerts a year, in addition to some summer offerings. And then I'm also in charge of the summer festival at the Lakeside Chautauqua, which, if anyone knows where that is, it's a beautiful spot right on the Marblehead Peninsula, right across the bay from Cedar Point in Ohio. And we gather a professional orchestra for 3 weeks in the summer and perform there over the course of those 3 weeks and collaborate with the ballet. And then, of course, full orchestral concerts in this huge Hoover Auditorium. And then I'm also director of orchestras or director of orchestral activities at Duquesne University. So that's my Pittsburgh connection. And of course, I love working with the students there and the faculty. And it's just a really wonderful music school. And there's actually quite a bit of cross-pollination happening now because the students at Duquesne are getting so good that they are winning positions with the Erie Philharmonic and the Westmoreland Symphony, in addition to other really fine regional orchestras in and around the Pittsburgh area. So there's certainly some opportunities for me to see those students beyond the walls of the Mary Papert School.
Amazing. So, tell us how you grew up, and your love of music blossomed.
Sure. Well, my mother is or was a vocal music teacher in the public schools for 30 years, and she's a wonderful pianist and organist, and she started us all off singing when we were, still in diapers. So music making was always a part of our household. And then I'm the oldest of four children in my family, and we each had the opportunity to study piano when we started kindergarten. So piano was a big part of my training. And then these were the glory years in the public schools outside of Cleveland, where when you hit third grade, the string teachers get a hold of you and they could get you enrolled in an orchestral program. So I started on violin in third grade and continued to study that well throughout my high school and collegiate years. And I was also an enthusiastic and an avid vocalist. So I was singing a lot and getting involved in any choir or performing opportunity that I could from the very beginning. So singing, playing a stringed instrument, playing piano, and just doing anything I could to get my hands on making music was a huge part of my life. And what's slightly strange about me is that I never entertained having a career in music, even though my mother had made a career in music and my dad was a business consultant. But it really wasn't I didn't have my lightning bolt moment until my collegiate years when I was also composing, was writing music and got a chance to conduct my own music. And that's when I really just got the conducting bug and realized that that was something that was really fascinating and invigorating and challenging and something that I really needed to figure out how to make a life in and make a career out of conducting music.
Who were some of your biggest mentors then throughout your studies, both graduate, postgraduate, as you grew up?
I think it's fair to say that my first music teachers, of course, were really important in instilling that sense of discipline, that sense that you need to practice and prepare for each new week. So that was really critical just to have that grounding in being ready for the next opportunity to play for your teacher and not wanting to disappoint her. In my case, I had a wonderful violin teacher, Wei Shu Wang Ko, who was the concertmaster of the Ohio Chamber Orchestra at the time, and some wonderful piano teachers when I was young, growing up in Cleveland, that kind of carried me through those whole years. And then once I hit undergrad, I had a wonderful mentor at Denison University, where I did my undergraduate years, a number of wonderful mentors. I was kind of a big fish in a small pond, because in my year, there were only three music majors at Denison at the time. So I had a lot of attention, and remember very fondly studying piano and talking about music with Keith Ward, and studying conducting and ensemble participation with William Osborne. And then I continued my studies at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, and had some fantastic conducting teachers there, including John Lehman and Earl Rivers and Elmer Thomas, among other really wonderful personalities there. And I mean, talk about a rich environment. I mean, the vocal talent and the instrumental talent at that particular conservatory is mind-blowing. And of course, those names then wind up on the rosters of the Metropolitan Opera and on Broadway stages. So you're catching these really incredible artists in their budding years. And I got a chance to collaborate with them and perform alongside with them. So that was another great learning opportunity.
And then how does Greensburg, the Westmoreland Symphony, come into your life?
So when I was a staff conductor for the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, I had an occasion on several opportunities to conduct the Westmoreland Symphony. And of course, it's only a 45-minute drive. And I thought, wow, I didn't realize that there was an orchestra of this quality. And of course, everybody was very serious and wanted to play these pieces really, really well. And I thought, this is what a wonderful resource. This is incredible. And of course, the orchestra is made up of essentially the finest freelance musicians in the region. So they're the really top musicians in southwestern Pennsylvania who aren't already in the Pittsburgh Symphony are candidates for and are filling in the chairs of the Westmoreland Symphony. And so the opportunity to work with these really fine musicians and make music on a high level was one that really got me excited about working with the group in a more traditional music director relationship.
Tell us your first impression of the Palace Theater.
I have always loved the Palace. The Palace is just the right size, I think, for orchestral music and for live music performance. It's of course it has, you know, a beauty. It's a former movie palace. This is one of the strange things about American orchestras, is that a lot of them perform in halls that were never originally intended to house orchestral music, which is to say, you know, even Heinz Hall in downtown Pittsburgh, that was of course a movie palace before it was even conceived of as a home for the Pittsburgh Symphony. So to think that something that was originally just a house for movies could then be acoustically viable and have a stage large enough for a symphony orchestra is, of course, something that symphonies have kind of figured out over the years. Even in Erie, Pennsylvania, where I'm music director there, we play in an old Warner movie house that's been meticulously restored. And then the stage and all of the backstage has been completely renovated to fit the needs of a modern symphony orchestra and modern traveling Broadway productions that need to come in and load in big sets and house big acoustical shells. So it's wonderful that, you know, the Palace works in that case, not only for amplified music and, you know, the rock and the country acts that come through, but I think it also works pretty elegantly as a place for acoustic music or music that's not amplified through microphones and amplifiers.
Why don't you talk for a few minutes about the orchestra itself? Do you, you know, are you really building this from the bottom up when you first come out to Greensburg, and compared to where it is now, which I think, you know, is really sort of smooth sailing in terms of the quality of musician?
Well, when I inherited the orchestra, it was already at a really fine level, and it was comprised of members of the Pittsburgh Opera Orchestra and the Pittsburgh Ballet. So musicians who decided to make Pittsburgh their home and to live a musical life in addition to playing in various regional orchestras. So in any glance of the Westmoreland Symphony, you'll see personalities, you'll see musicians who are also in demand in Wheeling, in Akron, Ohio, in the pit at the Pittsburgh Opera or the Pittsburgh Ballet, the Erie Philharmonic. Sometimes they substitute on the stage of Heinz Hall with the Pittsburgh Symphony. So these are already a very high class of musicians that populate the orchestra. And then, of course, we're lucky to live in a fertile area for music study. So really the finest graduate students, the master's students, the doctoral candidates, the artist diploma candidates, both at Duquesne and at Carnegie Mellon University, also populate this orchestra. And so you'll see some consistent figures that will be members of the orchestra for 5, 6, 10, 15 years. And then you'll also see some members that may only be in the orchestra for 2 or 3 years because this is where they've come to study. And then maybe they win a job in another city, or they move on to a different opportunity, or they become teachers in another community. But by and large, everyone who plays in the Westmoreland Symphony has some other engagement, whether it's a full-time job or putting together a portfolio of other music-making opportunities. And I would venture to say a large number of our musicians are also teachers in the community. So they share their knowledge and everything that they've learned and mastered about their instrument with the next generation of music makers. So it's really interesting to see how the orchestra stays the same in terms of consistency from year to year, but then how it also morphs from year to year based on the influx of the really fine students that are attracted to the great music schools here in our region.
Wonderful. And then you work together with administration to map out the year. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so in terms of programming for the Westmoreland Symphony, there are some things that we can take for granted. Like we will always be performing a live performance of the Nutcracker. And recently we've been working with Texture Ballet out of Murrysville, and we love working with them. They've just been so dependable and put together a really beautiful production from sets to the quality of the dancing. We're really, really happy with that kind of collaboration. Almost always been invited to perform, the weekend before or after July 4th in at the Robert Shaw Amphitheater right downtown in Greensburg. Of course, we've also have our signature series of concerts at the Palace Theater, so we're kind of in residence there, I guess you would say, at the Palace. So each year we know essentially where we're going to be playing and when we're going to be playing, and then it's really my job to take all the ingredients and put them together into different programs. So it actually starts probably 2 or 3 years in advance where we sit down. I actually have an artistic advisory committee made up of enthusiastic classical music lovers and board members and musicians in the orchestra. And we just throw around ideas. We talk about artists that maybe we've seen at some summer festivals or in other communities that we would love to bring. We talk about repertoire that the orchestra hasn't played in a while that we think would be great to bring back. We talk about all the different ingredients that we want to see on the stage and hear ultimately in the season. And then it becomes my job as the chief curator, if you will, or the chef, to take these ingredients and put them together into small menus that then are spread out over the course of the season. And of course, I'm looking at what we can reasonably rehearse over the course of our rehearsal periods, maybe some repertoire that helps build the orchestra and their sense of ensemble, but that also find repertoire that stays current with the trends that are happening in orchestral music right now. Right now, orchestras are looking very seriously into expanding their repertoire and making sure that everyone is represented, all races, all genders, all persuasions. We want to make sure that the music that we're playing really reflects the community in which we're playing. And, for a long time, admittedly, we go straight to the classics. We go to the Brahmses and the Beethovens and the Mozarts and the Tchaikovskys. But we now have an opportunity, particularly given the talent level in the orchestra, to really expand our view of what can be on those programs and what can inform the choices that we make in putting an individual program together, and then indeed the entire season. So I'm looking on a micro level from concert to concert to make sure each concert is fascinating and fun and enjoyable, if that's the only one you're coming to that year. But I'm also interested in creating a season that's interesting for our subscribers and for people that love the symphony so much that they'll come to everything that we offer over the course of the year.
I can't imagine that it hurts that you have connections all over the country because of where you've studied and how long you've been in the business. So I think you probably come across different musicians that you say, let's partner, let's do something with, and that probably happens regionally as well.
You know, that's interesting. The artist that we just had at our February concert, her name is Hanshi Wong, and she's a brilliant accordion virtuoso. And first of all, you don't really often get a chance to even hear an accordion on a classical orchestra stage, but she is such a captivating artist that I have had the opportunity to work with her on a number of occasions before and thought, this is definitely an artist I want to maintain a relationship with, but also introduce to my new orchestras or new situations. So in building that relationship with that the specific artist, I was then able to talk to her about what the opportunities were and what it might be like to play with the Westmoreland Symphony, and turned out to be just an absolutely incredible opportunity
Oh
and
my
a beautiful
goodness. I mean,
performance.
how did you come across her? Just.
You know, there aren't many accordion virtuosos on the planet, number one, and number two, those that have a repertoire of concertos or pieces that they can play with orchestra. And so she's on the cusp of developing a career where she will not only expand her own opportunities as a single artist, but she's also forwarding this idea that accordion is a viable solo instrument for an orchestra. And by saying that, I mean she's actually very actively cultivating composer friends to write new works for her so that she can expand her own repertoire, but also the repertoire of the instrument, so that 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, people will be looking back and saying, oh yeah, she was one of the premier artists of her day, and that she was instrumental, if you'll pardon the pun, in bringing new pieces to this fascinating instrument.
Smart young lady. I mean, really smart young lady to be able to do that. Interesting. We are going to talk in just a few minutes about shows upcoming in March and April at the Westmoreland Symphony. You're listening to Westmoreland Community Connections on WHJB. I'm your host, Jennifer Mealy. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Classic Hits 107.1. Listen live at WHJBFM.com.
Welcome back to Westmoreland Community Connections on WHJB. I'm your host, Jennifer Mealy, here today with Daniel Meyer from the Westmoreland Symphony. We're really excited to have you here. You're such a great person to interview because you're so interesting and so talented and quite an asset, I think, to Westmoreland County. I think many communities claim you as an asset, but today we'll take you in Westmoreland County for WHJB. Why don't you talk to us about March and April, the spring for the Westmoreland Symphony?
Excited about March in particular because there are two reasons to really celebrate what the orchestra can do and what it means to Greensburg. Number one is we, of course, love inviting soloists from within the ranks of the Pittsburgh Symphony to join us on stage as soloists. So Micah Wilkinson, who is principal trumpet of the Pittsburgh Symphony, will be coming and performing a concerto with us that evening. It's the Arutunian concerto. It's a great showpiece for solo trumpet. He's also coming and giving a master class at Seton Hill. So, a couple different ways to hear him, not only his incredible chops on the trumpet, but also his teaching ability and his ability to share his enthusiasm and his love for trumpet playing. And then we're going to pair that performance with Mahler's grand first symphony. It's nicknamed the Titan Symphony because Mahler really decided to make a huge impression on the musical world by writing this sprawling but powerful first symphony. And orchestras around the planet love playing it because it's such a wonderful vehicle to reveal not only that the power and the majesty that the orchestra can make and the sound it can make, but also showcase the virtuosity of the individual instruments. I think that was part of Mahler's genius, is that just as powerful and exciting as his music can be, it can also be tender or revealing of the different colors, the constituent colors that make up the membership of the Westmoreland Symphony in this case. So it's great to show our relationship to the musicians that live here and make their lives here, and particularly those that are stars on the Heinz Hall stage, but also our own stars on the Palace Theater stage in the fabric and the performance of Mahler's First Symphony.
Sounds wonderful. And that's coming up on March 9th. Tickets are available at westmorelandsymphony.org. I know there are many people who are already members of the symphony, but that shouldn't stop anyone who is interested in coming to a concert of jumping online and buying tickets there. And then we get to April 20th.
That's right. We're going to be featuring a wonderful chorus that we've put together over the past few years, made up of the finest vocalists in our region. And they're going to be performing Verdi's Requiem. And we're inviting a cast of vocal soloists, operatic soloists, to join us. And most, if not all, are alumni of the Pittsburgh Opera Resident Artist Program. So you'll get a chance to hear some of these really wonderful artists who got their start right out of conservatory in this fantastic program that the Pittsburgh Opera holds every year, where they invite young vocal talent to come and be in residence with the opera company and get small roles, but also get a lot of opportunities to perform in recital and throughout the community. So it's likely that some of these names and some of these faces will be familiar to our audience. And then, of course, the power and the majesty of Verdi's Requiem. It's a large piece. It's a singular statement. But a lot of people say it's almost like a Verdi opera in ecclesiastical clothing, which is to say all the drama and the passion that you would find in Otello or in La Traviata are found in the notes of the Requiem. But it's just a very passionate way of setting the original Requiem mass text for the Catholic Church, but in a very powerful concert setting. So it's unlikely that you would ever hear the Verdi Requiem performed in a liturgical setting, just because it's so sprawling and it's really more about the music than about the liturgy, dare I say. But of course, the liturgy and the drama and the passion of the text is what drives this wonderfully inspired music. There's even a moment in the Verdi Requiem where you'll hear a call from afar. It's almost like the end of days are signaled by by brass instruments and trumpets in particular, kind of blasting from the balcony. So it's designed in the score to be played from afar, so that the audience really feels like it's a heralding from a realm, a non-earthly realm, and it really creates a stunning effect in the hall. And I think the Palace Theater is going to be able to handle that. But we'll also, of course, have the huge choral forces and the orchestral forces all packed in on the Palace Theater stage in April.
Wow. 55th season you're in now. And your opening night is usually around October. And you try to change that up every year, although you have sort of your regular performances, right? That, like you said, the Nutcracker and then the Home for the Holidays, those are traditions. But the other concerts, I think you try to change up every year, correct?
Absolutely. And even with Nutcracker and Home for the Holidays, although it's a kind of a formula that we've found that works pretty well, of course, we're always looking for kind of a new twist or a new way to present some of these old favorites. And so you'll see little small tweaks from year to year. But I think in terms of the holiday concert, it's really, we're designed that to make it very family friendly, so that grandparents and parents and aunts and uncles and children alike will love what's happening on stage and really get into the spirit of the season. And then, of course, with Nutcracker, there's a grand tradition of the choreography, of course, that goes with it, and the beautiful costumes, and of course, the story and the set pieces. And frankly, the opportunity to hear a live orchestra with ballet, which isn't all that common anymore, which is unfortunate. But one thing that we're really proud of, that we've been able to preserve this tradition of live orchestral music and the full score of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker, which is a brilliant score, gets full orchestral treatment every year in the palace. So we all fit into that pit area just in front of the stage. And then, of course, the ballet company takes over the main stage in those performances.
Oh, it's wonderful. How important are patrons of music to keeping the symphony strong and viable?
You know, this really was driven home to me over the pandemic, which is to say we are so vitally connected to and need an enthusiastic live audience to perform for. We need that element. It's that unspoken of relationship, but we really do feel the presence and play off of and live for the energy that the audience brings us in live performances. Whether it's being completely rapt and listening to the music so intently and so completely that you don't hear a peep in the audience, you don't even hear a ruffling of a program book or any extraneous noise, or whether it's the eruption of applause at the end of a piece or an extended ovation where you can tell that people are so excited that they just want that artist to come back out on stage and play some more. That energy and that connection between the musicians of the stage and a passionate audience is something that we live for. It's our food. It's, I guess, actors would tell you the same thing when they are involved in a live theatrical production. Every night is different based on the energy and the reaction of that audience. And of course, that's the lifeblood of performing arts, is that we continue to breathe new life into these pieces because we have to. We can't hang music on a wall and appreciate it. It has to be rendered by musicians reinterpreting, rethinking, breathing new life into these works, whether it was written just a month ago or whether it's a piece that we continue to play from 250 years ago. It just, in all cases, we need supporters, we need audiences, and we need enthusiastic people who just love and understand the power of live music.
But you did get creative over COVID. You did get creative without having a live audience, I remember.
It's absolutely true. I mean, and I think creating that kind of material really honed our listening in a particular way, right? Because now all of a sudden everything goes under a microscope and everything is filmed and everything is live streamed. So that just gave us a different perspective or a different view on our music making. And it was actually, frankly, a little bit more challenging to be able to play with passion and play with that excitement without having necessarily all the audience in the hall that we're used to having.
Mm. I can't imagine how difficult that must have been. But fortunately, you can look back on that and say we survived it and we came out the other side and we're stronger than ever. I think the next thing, the last thing we'll do here, we have about 2 minutes left. Why don't you talk to families, parents of young children? Why is it so important to start these children today getting involved, coming to the Palace Theater, seeing these live musicians, perhaps even lessons? I mean, that was all important for you, and look at your career.
Absolutely. I think it's two things. One is forging a culture, mm-hmm. a culture of concert going, a culture of attending live performances, a culture of being an active performer and understanding what kind of discipline and what kind of enthusiasm and what kind of stress goes into preparing for a concert, but then also the incredible payoff of an audience, you know, getting up on their feet and applauding for someone who has invested a lot of time and energy and passion into cultivating that performance. And then the other, of course, is the forming of neural pathways. We know this from research. We know this from studying education over many years, that the pathways that you're forging when you're very young and studying a musical instrument or singing in a choir or performing in a show choir or even acting in a play, any of those things really help a young student focus and find pride in what he or she's doing and experience that wonderful joy and high, the highs and the lows of what it takes to succeed in the performing arts realm. And we know, I know this from my own work with youth orchestras and with university students, the best students are the ones that are also great musicians. I mean, MIT has a great student orchestra, and it's not because they have a music major, it's because they have all these incredibly talented and gifted young students who were both great in their academics, but also had that discipline and that drive focused into succeeding in a musical instrument.
Daniel Meyer is the artistic director of the Westmoreland Symphony Orchestra. The music that he brings to the community also brings so much happiness to our lives. We appreciate so much you sharing your time with us. Today, concerts are held at the Palace Theater. That's on Otterman Street in Greensburg. Free parking at the Bell Garage. If you have not experienced one of his concerts, you absolutely must make it a priority this spring. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jennifer. Thank you.
You're listening to Westmoreland Community Connections on WHJB.